This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
attacks on these villages were particularly egregious. These are communities, mainly farmers or pastoralists, who are already suffering from months of severe drought. They've been facing pressure for many months now from Al-Shabaab.
That's Letitia Bader of Human Rights Watch talking about increased violence by Al-Shabaab militants in Somalia's Lower Shabelle region. Details coming up.
Also, the World Health Organization is calling for stepped-up action to eliminate hepatitis B and C by 2030. And the Burundi government says the UN Refugee Agency is not doing enough to repatriate thousands of Burundians who fled the country due to political violence.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, a rights group says Al-Shabaab militants are escalating violence in Somalia's Lower Shabelle region, including displacement, abductions, stolen livestock, and burned villages. The region already has suffered from drought, inter-clan violence, and government and AU military operations against Al-Shabaab. Letitia Bader is the senior Somali researcher for Human Rights Watch. From London, she told VOA's Joe DiCapua that HRW has collected witness accounts of attacks on villages in Lower Shabelle.
Attacks on these villages were particularly egregious. These are communities, mainly farmers or pastoralists, who are already suffering from months of severe drought. They've been facing pressure for many months now from Al-Shabaab, threats to move from their areas and their land, and pressure which has made their life incredibly difficult. And then suddenly these raids started. Burning down of their homes, looting of livestock. I mean, you know, for many, their only means of survival. And also a lot of abduction of elders from the community as well. Now, this fits into ongoing violence and targeted attacks of civilians in this region. Lower Shabelle is one of the most volatile areas in Somalia, where all the Somali parties, clan militia, government forces have been involved in targeted attacks. Often reprisal attacks on civilians, ongoing pressure on these incredibly vulnerable communities.
So this is a complex situation. It involves inter-clan violence, reprisal attacks, drought. It's one big mess in a sense.
Very much so, and I think that's why it's time that the Somali government and also the international community really focus on the situation in Lower Shabelle. Of course, Al-Shabaab is responsible for these recent horrific attacks and should be held to account, but there are many players and actors who have gotten away with murder quite literally for many years in that region. And so it's really time to start weeding out those responsible for these abuses and really making sure that these incredibly vulnerable communities can get along with their everyday life. At least 15,000, and we think many more thousands of people have fled their villages as a result of these recent attacks. A lot of them have moved to Mogadishu, where, as we know, there's already thousands of people displaced because of the drought. But a lot of them have also fled to their region, to Lower Shabelle, where it's very difficult to get assistance for them, but it's absolutely critical right now to think about how to do that.
Now, Human Rights Watch has analyzed some satellite imagery. What did it show?
Basically, it shows how in the space of mid-May to mid-June, there was significant destruction of property in these villages. A lot of these villages are along what is a very strategic route from the port town of Merka up towards Askoy and then on to Mogadishu. So clearly a strategic area, but it just shows the concerted efforts to basically attack one village after another. Quite a few of the people I spoke to actually said, you know, this is not the first time we've been attacked or come under significant pressure, but never before had our homes been burnt.
Now, you talk about the Somali government doing something about this, but does the government actually have the capacity to take action?
The government can, first of all, make sure that their forces are not implicated in abuses which have been going on. That government forces are not restricting movement of those who are fleeing these attacks. but it's also really looking at what are the underlying causes of this violence. All the different parties have been responsible for serious abuses and have gotten away scot-free time and again. And so it's really time for the government to actually take this seriously, to make sure that there are proper investigations into what has been happening, and to make sure that people are not rewarded for these abuses, because that is also an ongoing concern, is that over the years, individuals who have been directly implicated in the abuses in this region, you know, have ended up remaining within government forces or continuing in positions of power. So it's important now that the government takes these issues seriously.
Letitia Bader is the senior Somali researcher for Human Rights Watch. From London, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The State Department's annual report on terrorism indicates that more than 1,700 ISIS terrorists were killed in Libya during counterterrorism operations. However, the Islamic State and other terrorist groups are still posing threats in North Africa. Tawfiq Hamid is the author of Inside Jihad, How Radical Islam Works, and a former member of Radical Islam Organization in Egypt. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi about the terrorism threats in Libya, Tunisia, and Egypt.
The issue of terrorism has a lot to do with the advances in technology. So even with small presence anywhere, if you have people who are committed to do such level of atrocities and they are ready to die, all what they need is money and technology. And with technological advances, it's very worrying to have ISIS in Africa. It can affect Mediterranean shipping of gas and oil, and it can also affect areas that's close to Somalia that can affect the transport to the Red Sea and Suez Canal. So they have some geopolitical areas that are very important they can control. Plus, if when there is chaos in any part of the world, it's easier for recruitment to this part to occur. It's affecting the whole global nature of the phenomenon of terrorism, which will ultimately affect all other continents and nations.
The report states that there are other terrorist organizations, including Ansar al-Sharia in Derna and Benghazi, Libya, and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, retained a presence in Libya. What does the international community need to do in Libya in order to counter such a threat?
Look, with Libya, initial elections brought the liberals to power. It was not in Islamic groups that came to power in Libya through democracy. But ultimately, the end was more radicalism, more terrorism. The radicals controlled the country, and the experiment of democracy failed. And this can lead to think that the most wise step that the West needs to do at this time is to define the most moderate, truly moderate faction and support them against the others. When you support both sides, the war can continue forever.
In Egypt, terrorists affiliated with the Islamic State in Sinai conducted numerous deadly and high-profile attacks on the government, on the military, and civilian targets throughout the country, despite the government's focus on counterterrorism. What's missing in Egypt that allowed the rise of such attacks?
The missing factor here is the failure to fight the ideology effectively and correctly. We cannot deny that the radicalism phenomenon has not been created only in the last few years in Egypt. It has been created over decades. But when you deal with it, you have not to wait to defeat the terrorists first and then start the war against the ideology. I believe an effective and efficient approach to the ideology must run at the same time. It may not probably show the fruits right away, but it's crucial to see more active steps in fighting the ideology than what's currently happening.
In Tunisia, terrorism remained a serious challenge. Terrorist attacks persisted in the Tunisian mountains and along the border with Libya. Is counter-terrorism measures enough to fend off that threat in Tunisia?
Of course not. We need always to think in counter-radicalism as a separate entity from countering terrorism. Terrorism is the outcome of radicalism. Radicalism is a mental phenomenon. Terrorism is a specific violent phenomena that uses weapons, bombs, other forms of violence. So you need to deal with this at the military level, security level. That's absolutely understandable. But if you really want to be efficient, you have to fight and counter radicalism as a separate issue to prevent the development of terrorists. So I believe Tunisia and other countries need to have specific programs that address the phenomenon of radicalism, how to defeat it effectively through media, through education, through other means.
That's Tawfiq Hamid, the author of Inside Jihad, How Radical Islam Works. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi.
On the eve of World Hepatitis Day, the World Health Organization is calling for stepped-up action to eliminate hepatitis B and C by 2030. It says the goal can be reached by scaling up diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of the diseases, which can cause death from cirrhosis and liver cancer. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters.
The World Health Organization reports viral hepatitis B and C affected 325 million people and caused 1.34 million deaths in 2015. The WHO is calling for the elimination of the public health threat by reducing new infections by 90% and death by 65% by 2030. Officials say it can be done if countries show the political will and invest in available tools to rid the world of the ailment. They say the epidemic of hepatitis B, which mainly affects the African and Western Pacific regions, can be prevented by vaccinating infants against the disease. In regard to hepatitis C, the director of the WHO Department of HIV Global Hepatitis Program, Gottfried Hirnschall, says there's been a sea change in the treatment of this disease. He tells VOA, until 4 years ago, no good treatment existed for hepatitis C, which kills nearly 400,000 people annually.
Then we saw the revolution. New drugs came on the market that are really fantastic drugs that have very limited side effects. You only have to take them for 3 months, and 95% or more are cured. And even those who are not cured in the first round, we now have even alternatives that we can provide to those.
Hirnschall notes the revolutionary kickoff of the new drugs was hampered by the huge $84,000 cost for the three-month course of treatment. But he says the cost in developing countries now has dropped to between $260 and $280. A survey of 28 countries, representing about 70% of the global hepatitis burden, finds efforts to eliminate hepatitis are gathering speed. It says nearly all the countries have set up high-level elimination committees, and more than half are allocating money to move the process forward. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Adolescent women in Africa have limited choices for preventing HIV, but one method that's showing promise is the vaginal ring. The results of the first trial of a monthly ring to prevent HIV in adolescents were presented this week at the 9th International AIDS Society Conference on HIV Science in Paris. HIV remains a leading threat to women's health and well-being worldwide, and nearly 60% of new infections among adults in sub-Saharan Africa are in women. Young women in the region are as much as three times more likely than young men to become infected with HIV. Dr. Zita Rosenberg is founder and CEO of the International Partnership for Microbicides, or IPM. She is also one of the scientists who developed the dapirolizumab ring for adolescents. She spoke with me about the findings of the trial and what it means for young women in Africa.
This study was a phase 2A safety study, and it was intended to look at the safety of the dapirolizumab ring, the vaginal ring, in adolescents from ages 15 to 17 in the United States. The study was conducted in multiple centers led by the Microbicide Trials Network and the Adolescent Trials Network of the NIH, and IPM is the developer of the ring and was part of the protocol call team. As was seen in adult women over 18, the ring is very safe in those women. It was shown to have a good safety profile. And in general, the women, the young adolescents, liked the ring very much and used it. So that was good because we know worldwide HIV risk in adolescents is very high. So we're trying to get together all of the background information so that the ring can eventually be hopefully approved for use in women under 18.
When that does happen, what will this mean for young women in sub-Saharan Africa?
Currently, the HIV prevention strategies that are available to young women in sub-Saharan Africa include the male and the female condom, which young women often cannot negotiate with their sexual partners. And there is the ongoing rollout of oral PrEP, which is oral Truvada, in these countries, but it is beginning very slowly. And so oral pills and oral PrEP has been shown in general to be very effective for the prevention of transmission of HIV. However, the uptake of oral PrEP in women in sub-Saharan Africa in previous trials was not very high. And there's a lot of studies now to try to improve adherence to oral Truvada. But there are also many women that may not be able to take a pill every day reliably. And just as in the oral contraceptive field, the family planning field, we know that women need a variety of options to be able to adopt one that fits in their lives. And the ring may be one of those options. The ideal would be a comprehensive package with many different approaches.
What has been the reaction there at the HIV Science Conference in Paris?
I think many people here know that the ring has been submitted to the European Medicines Agency for review. The European Medicines Agency will at some point render a scientific opinion on this product. If it is positive, then we would look for WHO pre-qualification of the product and then ask African countries to approve its use. We'll also be submitting to the South African Regulatory Agency later this year. And I think that people are excited about the prospect of the ring, assuming a positive scientific opinion and having data that shows its safety in adolescents. And there will be further studies on adolescent women in Africa called the REACH study that the Microbicide Trials Network and IPM will be conducting. And that is going to be very important from the perspective of getting real-world safety in African teenagers. This whole kind of package of information is what is providing, I think, the positive momentum thus far for the ring.
That was Dr. Zita Rosenberg. She's founder and CEO of the International Partnership for Microbicides, or IPM, and one of the scientists who developed the Dapirovin ring for adolescents. She spoke with me from the 9th International AIDS Society Conference on HIV Science in Paris. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580, and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Huhib, 23 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. There is an escalation of violence in Somalia's Lower Shabelle region caused by Al-Shabaab militants. And the World Health Organization is calling for stepped-up action to eliminate hepatitis B and C by 2030. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The Burundi government says the UN Refugee Agency is not doing enough to repatriate thousands of Burundians who fled the country due to political violence. On a trip to Tanzania last week, President Pierre Nkurunziza called on refugees there to go home, saying the country was safe. Reporter Moses Habayarimana has more on the story from Bujumbura.
During President Nkurunziza's trip, his call for Burundians to return home had support of Tanzanian leader John Pombe Magufuli. He urged them to voluntarily return, saying Burundi had become more stable. Violence erupted in April 2015 when Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in the office. He won re-election, but hundreds died in violence since then, and several hundred of thousands of people fled to neighboring countries. Burundian Foreign Affairs Minister Ali Nyamitwe says that the UNHCR has imposed some obstacles to Burundian refugees who are seeking to voluntarily repatriate.
We had received reports that thousands of refugees had indicated their need to repatriate, but were faced with some administrative impediments imposed on them by the UNHCR in particular. And that is unfortunate, because once becoming a refugee is a right, but also repatriating is a right.
Regardless of the improved security situation in the country, some opposition leaders don't feel safe to return to the country. Many fear being persecuted. Burundi government says that majority of the citizens who fled the country were manipulated by the opposition forces.
It is unfortunate that they might be manipulating thousands of citizens. Each individual, you live your life, and nobody should tell you what to do with your life. Or you should not align your fate or your life with fortunes of a political leader. If the politicians that are concerned decide to stay outside the country, it is their choice. But that is their choice, which should not be imposed on innocent citizens.
The UNHCR mandate for voluntary repatriation has been extended beyond helping refugees return home. It now includes securing protection and providing assistance to returnees in the country of origin. The UN agency declined to comment on the government criticism. Opposition leaders outside the country have expressed their concerns about going home. Jean-Baptiste Baribonekeza is the chairman of the Burundi National Human Rights Commission.
Burundians outside the country, of course, belong to different categories, so to speak, even in terms of, you know, the motivations to leave the country or the reasons why they couldn't return. Among the politicians, for example, there are some who just decided to leave the country in order to show their disagreement with the decisions that were being taken at the political stage.
The UN Secretary General's Special Envoy, Michel Kafando, recently addressed the United Nations Security Council on the current political situation in Burundi. He said an inclusive dialogue involving both parties was the only way to restore peace and stability in the country. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Cornelius Tenner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share the ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.